TFM.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Mar Talker on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as he always is my esteemed co-host, Matthew Rushing. And Matthew, I'm really sorry to keep you waiting this morning. I know you've been sitting around, but I've spent the past 2 hours shape-shifting. And I've got to tell you, I've become everything in my studio, but I have no more idea what it is to be a microphone than I did before.
Well, I don't know if it amplified your voice or not, but it is great that you're back so that we can talk about some Deep Space Nine and, well, some serious Odo issues.
Yeah, we've got some serious Odo issues here in the second part of The Search, which we will talk about today as we conclude our two-part look at the Season 3 opener. So let's just start with that, Matthew. Odo finds a home. We got there at the end of part one, and now we open with the changelings coming out of the Great Link to talk to Odo. And it's such a huge advancement of the Odo story and a huge step forward for the series as a whole as we're finally interacting with the changelings.
Yeah, I think, this is obviously a huge pivot for the show. And what's really cool about this is that, you know, this is not a show that ended up making you wait 7 years or whatever to find out who Odo is, who he was related to, what his story is. You know, this is fantastic that that's not the case, because I think a lot of shows, they try to drag things on forever. I mean, as a silly example, you could think of Ross and Rachel, 10 years of they, won't they kind of thing, you know? And so here we have been teasing about Odo's past and his lineage and all of those things since the beginning of the series. And so it makes good on that promise by finally helping us not only to answer that question, but explain quite a bit then about why Odo is the way he is as a person, and make him make a terrible choice, have to put that choice of, like, do you choose who you grew up with, or do you choose your family, or, you know, the family you didn't know you had, now you found. So I just think it's such a great addition to the character. And of course, I mean, this might be one of the most interesting introductions to what will become, you know, a Star Trek villain in a very, very long time, because they are truly terrifying.
But they don't seem that way when you first meet them. Not in the same way that, like, the Borg did when they first appeared in Q-Hu.
I mean, I would say that they are terrifying, though, in a completely different way.
Yeah.
Because in many ways, they are similar to the Borg, right? The Borg are looking for perfection, and they assimilate people into their collective to create that. Well, the Dominion is looking for order, and so they assimilate people, or they, you know,
not they literally conquer, individuals, but cultures.
Right. Yeah. But they conquer races and force them into their order in much the same way that the Borg do. And so I think, to me, they're really two sides of the same coin, which is absolutely fascinating. It shows that the ultimate scariness in Star Trek is to lose autonomy and individuality and freedom. Mm-hmm. And this is just another way in which that happens. And of course, you know, we are hearkening back to totalitarian regimes, especially throughout the 20th century, with this idea as well, this imposed order. And so, you know, I think all of those things together, to me, in some ways, make this scarier than the Borg, because this is something that we as human beings have actually experienced, whereas, you know, the threat from the Borg is completely a sci-fi invention and will most likely always be just a sci-fi invention.
Maybe, most likely. It could become true in the future.
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, you never know. So
you never know, but we might do that to ourselves.
Let's hope it's, you know.
Yeah. Well, that's an interesting comparison between the Dominion and the Borg. Yeah, that's something that I usually don't think of them in that sense, but it is true that there is that great similarity between them. I feel like their introduction here and their threat is a quiet one compared with mm-hmm. someone like the Borg, who is relentlessly sure. coming after you. Here, the founders are just sitting back and mm-hmm. they're very frightening, in that you know that threat is out there. Mm-hmm. You know it's very powerful. It could come for you at some point, but they're going to make their move when they feel the time is right, which is what a lot of this episode is about, as we'll discuss. Them feeling out the situation, mm-hmm. trying to determine when the timing might be right, what the right moves to make might be. And the way they go about that is also very frightening.
You know, something that you were saying there, Chris, I think is really true, because, you know, I think the Borg are just this kind of bombastic menace, whereas I think the Dominion is the silent menace. Mm-hmm. You know, they are the ones who they're, or you could say the quiet menace. They come off very quietly. They are the ultimate version of, you know, Teddy Roosevelt's walk softly and carry a big stick, because their stick is the Jem'Hadar.
Are they the Phantom Menace in a sense?
Yes, exactly. I mean, you know, that's kind of what I was playing off of, except exactly. They're not quite Phantom here now,
but they are
quiet.
They are quiet.
So yes. And they even talk quiet, you know, so
they do, don't they? Especially that male changeling. Boy, talk about protesting.
He was really worked up. I was surprised that, you know, that she allowed him to even live after that, like raising his voice that high.
I know.
Oh, my goodness.
Wow. Talk about a disturbance in the link. Well, sticking with Odo for a moment, I did want to ask you, do you think that the Odo character could have continued on the series? I don't mean like he would be gone from the series, but as a very interesting character who we care about following through to the end of the series, do you feel like he could have really continued without this type of major turn in his story? Because we knew him up to this point as the security officer. We knew that he was looking for justice, as he would put it. Although I think it's interesting here that the female changeling tells him that it's not justice that you seek, it's order. Just like us. But just think about this huge change and think about how the character might have continued if he had just remained the Odo that we've seen up to this point.
I mean, he absolutely could have continued, but I would argue that by giving us this piece of the story when they do, it makes him an infinitely more interesting character as we move forward, because it creates this tension that you have then, and the tension of the choice that he feels forced to make in this episode between one side or the other. And, you know, I think what is great about that is that so many people that resonates with tension that they've had in their own life, right? Which is they have absolutely had to choose between two sides. You know, people with families who of divorce and those kind of things, I think, were the most resonant for this. Yeah. But then there are others, you know, who have felt like they've had to choose between other sides of issues. And so I think this is great. And I think It also plays in just to the larger themes, I think, of these two episodes, which become the different sides of the Federation and the Dominion and their way of viewing the universe. They are diametrically opposed to one another, which is why Odo finds himself on a different side. Part of that, too, I think, is that he has his tribe. And because this new one is one which is opposed to the one he's a part of, it makes it harder for him to want to choose that in the first place, you know? So I just, there's a lot going on, which I think is fantastic. And so to answer your question, I could have, but they did the exact right thing here by giving such depth. And what it does is it not only gives depth to Odo, but it just gives depth the entire series now, because there is this, and it's not even an existential threat. There is this threat looming out there that kind of begins to weigh over season three, of course, season four, and then on into the rest of the series. And so I think this was the perfect place to finally kind of introduce that and use that as one more building block.
Yeah. Yeah. You gave the example earlier of how TV shows sometimes drag things out. There's this mystery or question. Ross and Rachel, maybe I wouldn't classify as a mystery, but it was a question and it gets dragged out. And Deep Space Nine, as we mentioned last time, and we talk about pretty much all the time, is about the characters more so than about the sci-fi events surrounding them. And this is a case where it's so much more satisfying and so much more true to the show, to the concept of Deep Space Nine, that they go ahead at the start of season three and they reveal the mystery of who Odo is, so that for the rest of the series, Odo's search is not for his people, but for his own identity. They can really focus on him as a character, whereas they could have gone just a simple sci-fi route and had it be where his search for seven seasons was to find out where he came from. And then, as you mentioned earlier, we get that reveal at the end of the series, near the end of the series. And I think that would be, that would feel quite unsatisfying in a modern TV series where the entire story plays out in one season, in half the number of episodes of a traditional season. I would still feel unsatisfied if that were the payoff that I got from watching that one season. And in a case like Deep Space Nine, where we have to watch for 7 years, literally, I would especially have felt a bit disappointed in that payoff. So here, get that out of the way from the beginning, and then let's get into true character exploration on an individual level. I think it works quite well.
Well, it is one of the things that, you know, we have talked about, you and I, about the struggle that you can have sometimes when you have a shorter run show that's very serialized, is that plot seems to many times take over for character.
Yeah, definitely.
And so I think both you and I would absolutely agree then. That's one of the reasons I think we're really loving season two of Picard, as we're talking about in The Artificial Tango, because this story is servicing the character study of the character of Picard, right? And so this is one of those places where they use this on Deep Space Nine to not only further the storytelling abilities that they have by opening a proverbial Pandora's box of changelings to unleash on the galaxy, but they give us incredible storytelling opportunities with how we're going to explore Odo, but also how we're going to explore his relationship with everybody around him because of this, as well as what this revelation is then going to do to everybody else on the station, everybody else in the Alpha Quadrant and the Beta Quadrant. So, I mean, it's really just great storytelling in that sense.
What did you think about the reveal of the great link, what it is, how it connects to Odo, how the female changeling explained what the great link is and how they're connected to one another, and therefore how Odo is connected to them, even if he is an outsider at the moment?
Yeah, I think that was a great idea. I think, you know, it's sufficiently vague in the sense that they kind of explain it, but it almost feels like you're trying to grasp the idea of the Trinity. It's like mm-hmm. you can kind of get it, but there's still so much that feels kind of ununderstandable about it. And, you know, I think this is definitely one of those things where to try and understand a part of the whole and a whole of the part, you know, is a mind-bending, great sci-fi idea. And I think they don't try to over-explain it.
No.
They just give you enough to make it feel alien. And what's great about this, too, is that this is one of the most alien of species that we've ever met in Star Trek, especially ones that we're going to spend quite a bit of time with, which is really cool.
Yeah, it's true. Usually when we meet alien species who are really different from the standard humanoids that we encounter, we don't spend a lot of time with them, right? They're usually in one episode. Maybe they reappear from time to time. There's someone like the Tholians who pop up here and there, but we don't interact with them in the same way that we normally interact, and therefore the character exploration is a lot more difficult to do with those types of aliens. You can do interesting scientific concepts. Star Trek Discovery ended with something like that in season 4 that was interesting, but to have someone who's very alien, who you have a harder time communicating with or understanding, we don't see as often in Star Trek. And even here, mm-hmm. they don't go overboard with that alien nature, because we are able to communicate with the Great Link and the Changelings through the female Changeling,
right,
using English or Federation standard. And there is still a very familiar element to the dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
One thing that I thought was interesting, the comment that the female Changeling made here that we can apply to the world today, I think maybe even more so than at the time that it was written. When Odo doesn't understand why he needs to shapeshift, she tells him to become a thing is to know a thing. To assume its form is to begin to understand its existence. And I think if you just pull that back to a more human everyday level, just the message of trying to put yourself in someone else's shoes, try to see something mm-hmm. from a different perspective, you will begin to understand the world better, and right. you can bridge gaps that we have in communication, socially. Mm-hmm. You can become more tolerant, and we can all come back together in a way that, like, overall life can be improved. And I think that that's one of the things that the Great Link represents, is this larger community and finding some form of unity. And the Changelings experience that, and I would say that we mostly don't. I don't think we want to go to the extreme of being in the Great Link, but
mm-hmm.
I think that her message has, it's good advice.
Well, and what's interesting about it is how they do not follow their own advice, because mm-hmm. they other solids.
Mm, yeah, right.
And yeah. by othering them and making them less than human, we'll just put it, because those are the only terms we have, you know, they then can do whatever they want. That's how they legitimize controlling everyone, because that's what seems right in their eyes, you know? Mm-hmm. And so her advice is fantastic, and yet she does not find her advice. They do not follow her advice whatsoever when it comes to other beings, because they fear other beings and they fear what other beings can do to them. But when fear is the only thing that drives you, then it legitimizes you to do terrible things. And, yeah. and that's exactly, again, what they do to other people. And so I just think, you know, it's really, really good writing. And I think that the Deep Space Nine writers were just really on to something, and it's way before their time, right? But it is, You know, you think the early 90s are actually kind of the place where a lot of the strife that we have really, I think, begins to evolve and to grow to what we see today.
Yeah.
And it's only gotten worse since that point. But I think their message is still 100% reticent here. And it's something that we honestly should pay attention to, which is that if we don't put ourselves in each other's shoes and we never try to understand another person or another side of an issue, then we are going to be left with only two choices, or we're going to feel like we're only left with one choice, which is you're the enemy and you must be destroyed.
Right. Yeah. Which is what happens in the series when the Dominion
yes.
seeks to destroy the Federation and the Alpha Beta powers. Okay, let's move on to the other core part of this story, which is how the Dominion is filling out the relationships between the Alpha Beta powers, how Sisko, as the commander of the Starfleet, the Federation operations at the other end of the wormhole, how he would react to certain steps they might take, and so forth. And the way they do this, I think, is really interesting. And it's one of those things that you can only experience once, because after you've seen the episode one time and you know what's happening, it all reads a bit differently. So I'm going to ask you the most difficult question ever posed on the orb. Can you remember how you felt watching this episode the first time when you didn't know that you were watching a simulation?
You know, I think even when it originally came out, there was absolutely a feeling that this isn't right.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way they do that, because, of course, the whole point of this simulation, right, this unreality, is to play upon the paranoia and to ramp it up as fast as possible with these characters so that the Dominion can make their assessment.
Well, they only had 44 minutes to do it, Matthew. They had
exactly.
to
yeah,
keep it moving 44. Along.
Yes. But I think with that kind of ramping everything up is this really great understanding of, you know, who the Dominion is, and the fact that, you know, when you rewatch the episode and you're able to kind of piece everything together, it really does come together what they're trying to do and what they're pushing towards. And, you know, I think what makes this so interesting, and I really liked that you called this section on the outline unreality, is that it is an unreality. They are being pushed in this simulation to a point which doesn't make a lot of sense. Because if you're entering peace negotiations with people, it wouldn't look like this or work like this at all. And I think what's fascinating by doing this is that they actually hurt their relationship with the Federation from the start by starting this way, because you immediately make the Federation feel defensive because of treating them like this. And then, of course, you know what she says at the very end, which is, yeah, we'll see when the time is right. You know, it's like you just know it's coming. It's not going to be good.
Right, right. Well, they treat them this way because they see themselves as far superior to any solids, right? So they're going to do the things, they're going to do things the way they want to do them. And they're not considering really how the other side would react to like a truly honest attempt to build some sort of relationship between the two sides.
Mm-hmm.
They are trying to see how they would react to specific actions that they might take. Yeah. My memory of watching this the first time, obviously, is very cloudy because it was when it first aired and so many years have passed, but I kind of remember watching it, and at first it seems like, you know, you're watching a normal story, and then bit by bit you feel like this is a little bit odd, this is a little bit odd, and then as you get closer to the end, you know, like something is up here, something is weird. And when I rewatch it, knowing everything that happens, I think it's interesting how the writers drop the clues and how they ramp things up bit by bit. And things become, they go from being a little bit odd, like how did Miles and Jadzia suddenly appear to help them? And then it becomes ridiculous, like Tyrol being shot as she runs down and falling into the arms of Sisko. So it goes from like something's a little bit off, and then you've got characters acting as you would expect them to, Garrick and Quark. They're behaving just as you would expect them to behave in a normal situation. You know, Quark is, he's just happy that there's going to be this opportunity to make money. He says, I have a dream that one day all people, human, Jem'Hadar, Ferengi, Cardassians, will stand together in peace. Now that you might think, are you sure that's Quark? That's kind of a little bit odd. And then he says, around my Dabo tables. Bashir says, you're a real visionary, Quark. And you think, okay, that's our normal Quark. But then things start to become a bit odd. You know, Nechayev's, I think, always been this kind of direct admiral in how she addresses things. But the discussion that she's having with Sisko, you feel a little bit like you would expect the Starfleet admirals to be a bit more collaborative with Sisko in a situation like this, instead of just making the decisions and telling him. So in that sense, you feel like that's weird. And then, like I said, by the end, everything is just becoming a bit absurd. And then Barath says, let's tell him what's going on.
Well, and I think one of the things that makes this work for as long as it does is by choosing her. Because she's always been a prickly admiral in the first place. And so I think by choosing her, you're like, there is that point where it crosses the line. You're like, okay, this can't be real, right? But for a while, you know, because it's her, you're like, well, she's just kind of like this in general, so maybe this isn't so this is normal.
Well, talking a bit more about what she's explaining that they've decided to do, at one point she tells Sisko it's the price of peace. And, you know, you've mentioned that one of the themes of this episode is them, and think about our own culture as well, trying to decide what is the price that we're willing to accept. In this case, what is the price of peace? What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an even more salient theme than ever before, because I think we are living in a world that acquiesces more and more to evil and, you know, terrible ideas because we are so risk averse. And I think we see that across the spectrum. And so whether that comes to the idea of, you know, this type of alien or threat, you know, a threat, you know, militarily, or just you can take that as far as you want to go. I really do think that this is a theme that just really struck me, because asking that question, you know, there is a too high of a price, right? And being able to figure out what that is, I think, is something that does take clarity and moral thinking. It does take careful consideration, but I do think that there is a price that is too high. There is a price that's too high in so many ways. And so, yeah, this was, it's one of those places, you know, we say this so many times as we talk about this show, but where what they wrote then is just as important now, if not more so. And that is incredible writing for a television show to continue to say things to which feel like they're written for the time period you're watching it in, even though it was almost 30 years ago.
Yeah. Well, when you're dealing with armed conflict or potential armed conflict, as is the case here, it's such a timeless theme in human history. And unfortunately, it's, as we're seeing today, it's not going away anytime soon. And how you deal with that is where risk aversion really comes into play. And in the case of this story, you know, Deep Space Nine started as a series with Bajor needing protection and help to recover from an occupation by the Cardassians. So the Federation comes in, and keeping it on the Federation side, because, you know, we see ourselves as the good guys, even though the good guys never say that, according to Star Trek Picard, yeah. Which was a great line. But the idea here that the Federation, and of course, it's not really the Federation's view, because this is the founders putting this out as a filler to see how Sisko would react to it. But the idea that the Federation would think that we'll abandon this mission, we'll pull away from this part of space, we will abandon the wormhole, we'll kind of retreat back into our own borders more, and that will protect us. We'll kind of turn a blind eye to this threat, give the other side what they want, and we will be safe. And do you think that if they had done that, the Dominion wouldn't have decided to expand its borders and come after them anyway? So is it really the price of peace? Would there be peace?
Yeah, I think that is an interesting thing. And it does seem to be almost more the question is not what is the price of peace for the Federation. It is more, what is it going to take to put this quadrant into war?
Mm-hmm.
And how far do we need to push them so that we can create a war so then we can, you know, take everything over and control this quadrant. To me, in many ways, you know, rewatching this, that's where I kind of come to in this, is that I don't think this is as much about peace as it is what does this group need to do to create war between the Alpha Quadrant powers, which is, even though I know it was not intentional, what then I think plays in to season four with the Klingons really makes a lot of sense then, because it's the first foray into, yeah, well, how far do we need to push these people into war?
Yeah.
What do we need to do to destabilize this Alpha Quadrant, this Beta Quadrant?
Well, that's what they're feeling out for sure. Yeah, it's an interesting point that I don't think it was intentional at this point with the Klingons, because they weren't planning to write that storyline.
Yeah.
But
yep.
But
just in the long run, it feels like it.
Right. Well, they did a great job of adjusting when they had to do the Klingon storyline and picking up this idea of the Dominion looking for ways to splinter the powers that be in the Alpha and the Beta Quadrant. Because at this point, the focus is on the Romulans. We've got that whole thing as it's getting more absurd towards the end, of T'Rul being outraged because the Romulans have been left out of the negotiations. And they're like the only ones who haven't been there. And of course, the founders are trying to see, well, what if we took one big power and we excluded them from things?
Mm-hmm.
What would that do to the balance that's keeping peace more or less in this area of space at this time? So then when the Klingons have to come into the picture for the series, they just expand that to an empire that we know better and I think more fans are interested in than the Romulans. So they were able to use this as a great springboard to advance the series.
Mm-hmm.
What did it seem like, again, this is, you know, there's a simulation going on here at the end, but Sisko was concerned about the wormhole, and he asks Nechayev, will they get to protect that too? And that's when she says it's the price of peace. And he says, well, if you ask me, the price is too damn high. But then later in the simulated events, they're going to go and destroy the wormhole as a way of sealing off the Dominion. And Sisko seemed to be okay with that. How do you see that part of the story, knowing that we're in this unreality, but then knowing the importance of the wormhole to Sisko himself as the story goes on?
What I see is that Sisko realizes that with the power the Dominion has, with the allies they are winning to their side, this is a war that is going to rage across the Alpha and Beta quadrants in a way that has rarely been seen since, you know, the Romulan Earth War. And so I think it's great. I think Sisko, he knows he's doing the right thing to save billions upon trillions of lives. And I think what's fascinating there is that we truly learn just how far Sisko is willing to go to pursue a peace that he can live with, right? Which harkens all the way to In the Pale Moonlight, where he's like, I can live with it. Like, he's willing to live with no celestial temple if it means that the people of Bajor are safe and that the Alpha and Beta quadrants are safe from the Dominion in the first place.
Yeah. What I think is interesting as a thought exercise in all of this, because of course the writing evolved and they made different decisions with the character, and it's easy to look back and see things that weren't really there in the beginning, but everything that you just said, his view of that, how that evolves as his relationship as the emissary evolves, is interesting. What price would be too high for him as the emissary versus a Starfleet commander who's been put in charge of this space station, and how that all evolves, and what might he have thought in this situation if this were 2 years later?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, and I think that's one of the things that makes this so interesting, right? You give him this simulation here, and then I think what it does is it gives you the opportunity to see him specifically as a character really grow.
So one other thing I just wanted to mention, because I love the line, is when Garak helps them escape. Again, I thought this was true to Garak's character, right? Where, like, it seems like he's doing one thing, but then he's doing something else. He's always this kind of plotting and planning and deceptive kind of character. But he's carrying them through, and the Jem'Hadar, he tells Bashir, I'm glad to see the plan is going according to schedule. And the Jem'Hadar says, what plan is that? And Garak says, you mean no one told you? You see, I pretend to be their friend, and then I shoot you. And he shoots him, and Sisko says, well done, Garak. And then Garak's line is what I love. He says, well, it's just something I read once in a book. And that line, it was so Garak, and the way it was delivered was so great. And then rewatching this last week, I actually tweeted, I think, I could picture our friend Una McCormick writing that line, because she loves Garak, and of course she loves books so much, not only as an author, but as a reader. And it just sounded like a line she would give Garak. Mm-hmm. But of course,
yeah,
this was long before she was writing DS9 stuff. So,
yeah, no, I 100% agree. I that's just great stuff.
I love that line. So one more thing I wanted to ask you about before we get into our final thoughts is, where does this two-part episode stand amongst all DS9 episodes? Empire Magazine did a list some years back of the 50 greatest TV shows of all time, and they ranked Deep Space Nine as number 47, which is a little suspicious to me, putting a Star Trek series at number 47. But anyway, DS9 was on the list. But they called The Search the best episode of Deep Space Nine. Do you think it's the best episode of DS9? Or can you see reasons why they might choose this out of all the great stories on DS9 as the best of them all?
You know, I don't think this is the best of Deep Space Nine, but I do think it's, you know, if you're creating a list of like the top 10, and I would say probably stories of Deep Space Nine, mainly because there are some that are just one episode, but then there are some, I think, like the Circle arc, like that's an entire story. So I think you could count that. But this is definitely up there. And I think the best part about this is the fact that they are creating something to which is going to permeate the rest of the series with what they do here.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing that does make this so good. And it's one of those, like, you know, I wouldn't personally call this the best episode of Deep Space Nine with The Search Part 1 and 2. But it's absolutely top 10, maybe top 5. I mean, gosh, Chris, maybe that's an episode we should do where we give our, like, top 10.
Yeah.
You know, stories of Deep Space Nine episode. That there we go. We've got an episode, folks.
Okay, we can do it. It's a really tough one to do. And I think one of the challenges
is, right?
It is really difficult.
Because I'm sitting here thinking like, oh my gosh, how do I, you know, categorize what I think is the best?
Yeah, but that's the thing.
This, like, really is one of them. So
that's the thing. So like for standalone stories, for me, I think that The Visitor, Far Beyond the Stars, these are two of my favorites, duet, but it's a different kind of story. Mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult because stories fall into different types. And I think one of the challenges with Deep Space Nine for someone trying to choose what is the best episode is that, unlike The Next Generation, where you do have individual episodes and occasionally you have a two-parter, but that's it. Here you have these arcs. You know, we've done things on the Orb before where we've done like the whole opening of season 6, for example. And it's more difficult with DS9 to pluck a single episode out and say, this is the best episode or this is the best episode. I can see one reason that they may have felt that this is the best episode is that I think this story strikes a nice balance for Star Trek fans, for viewers, between the two styles of Star Trek at the time, the more traditional style that we saw in The Next Generation and in the early seasons of DS9, and then the more complex, character-driven, drawn-out plots of Deep Space Nine that we get after this and moving forward. It's got both of those going on in here. I think it's easier to watch as a Star Trek fan who prefers the traditional storytelling style than some of the later DS9 episodes are. And so if you look at it that way, with that balance, that could be a reason for them to cite it as the best of the series. But yeah, I don't know if I'm with you on it even being in the top 10. Mm-hmm. Because there are so many episodes to choose from. So maybe we should do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, orb. I think it would be great.
And let's see. Like, let's make our top 10 lists. Don't tell each other at all what we're choosing until we discuss it on the show.
Yeah.
See where we overlap, see where we don't, see where we think.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right in the sense that I think it is just incredible how good the series is. And it's one of those things where you do run across so many episodes, you're like, oh man, that could be the best, you know. And there are some on the top of my head where I'm like, okay, I know these are probably like in the top 5 here, but when you start to list out what the other episodes could be, there just really are so many. Like you mentioned the episode Duet, right? Like, so anyway, I mean, we'll talk about it on that episode, but
yeah.
Suffice it to say, this is a phenomenal two-parter. And again, you know, I think this sets up the rest of the series. You know, in many ways, this is the thing that kind of charts the course then for where the rest of the series is going to go. And they find a way to keep themselves on track, even though they do take some nice little oxbows, you know, in the river to get there, but they're going to get there. And so, but in the end, Chris, yeah, I absolutely still adore these episodes. And, you know, I don't even think this one really, you know, these don't need ratings. I think in the end, they both hold up. And what's great about this, too, I'll say this. Sometimes you get two-parters in Star Trek, and the second part doesn't know how to land the ship.
Yeah, right.
I absolutely believe that this one not only lands the ship, but it ups the game in a way that just leaves you kind of, like, breathless and quite a bit worried for the characters that you love, because you're just not quite sure what's going to happen now.
Yeah. Yeah, it does conclude the setup very well. And as I said last time, I think the two parts contrast really well with the family building and the evolution of the story in the first part, and then the looming threat of the Dominion and the mystery in the second part. So it has a nice contrast setup and resolution. And yeah, it just sets up the series so well. I sometimes try to imagine what the series might have been like if this episode had not started season three and really laid that foundation for them to move forward. It could have happened later on, of course, but I just think the timing was right. And I think the way that they picked up the events that closed season two and used that to move the series forward, to really push it forward, to not stick with the types of stories that we were getting up to that point, but to really say, okay, we're going to try something different here. Let's really take Star Trek in a new direction. I'm so glad they did it. And I think this episode completely sets it up fantastically. And so we're not going to give ratings for this one. I guess we'll just give it like one great link, right?
Yes.
It's just all connected. All right, everyone. We would love to hear your thoughts on The Search Part 2 or the story as a whole. There are many ways for you to do that. Perhaps the best way is to go to Facebook and join the Babel Conference. That's our closed listeners group. If you're already a member, you know how it works. But if not, just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and it should come up. If not, just type the whole name. It is a closed group for our listeners, so please answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. We'll put a post for this episode there. You'll also find one for The Search Part 1, which we talked about on the previous episode of The Orb, and you can share your thoughts there with us and fellow listeners and extend the conversation beyond the podcast. If you'd like to send us email, you can do that by going to our website, trek.fm/contact. Use the form you find there. Choose to send to a show and choose The Orb, and that'll come to Matthew and me by email. And you can find us everywhere in social media. Our username is TrekFM. Find us on Twitter. We'd love to chat with you there. Also Instagram and elsewhere. Now, Matthew, when you're not trying out that nifty Dominion VR gear, you know, for your own enjoyment, where can people find you?
Well, when that's not happening, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02, Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, Vero, any of those places. Of course, here on the network, you'll find me on the other side of the orb with all of the shows we do with the 602 Club, because we don't like to just talk Star Trek. We like to talk all of the fandoms that we love. And so you can check out the 602 Club, Snyder Cuts, as well as Assembling Avengers, all in the same feed. We've got loads of good stuff there for you, so I hope you'll check that out. And of course, we're also doing Warp 5, Literary Treks, and The Artificial Tango. Warp 5, Chris, you and I are walking through all of Star Trek Enterprise as we celebrate 20 years of that show. Literary Treks is about the books and the comics of Star Trek. And then, of course, The Artificial Tango, we already mentioned here, we've been talking through Star Trek Picard Season 2 and just having a whale of a good time. So hopefully people will check that out. And then Of course, you can also find me over on the Nerd Party Network. I've got a finished show over there called Owl Post that I did with Drea Kaufman. We talked about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. And then last but not least, Aggressive Negotiations that I'm doing with John Mills is a Star Wars podcast. And, you know, if you liked that Star franchise, I hope you will check that out. But Chris, when you're not trying to just sit down and enjoy your Ractigino without somebody being shot in your arms, where can people find you?
It is hard to hold on to the Ractigino when that happens. So, yeah, I prefer to avoid that. I'm just sitting around here, you know, pondering something you just said. You said that we're having a well of a time on the Artificial Tango. And now I'm just wondering what happened to George and Gracie in that timeline? Because we saw the guy on the bus. What happened to the wells?
That is a phenomenal question. My guess is that they were hunted to extinction again.
Probably so. Probably so. But when I'm not pondering that, you can find me, as you mentioned, here on the network doing Warp 5 with you to talk Enterprise, Picard on the Artificial Tango. There's Interphase, a Star Trek Universe podcast, and Larry Nemechek and I do the Ready Room from time to time. And also I'm working on things behind the scenes. And if you'd like to chat with me about Star Trek or Japan or Wales or whatever, the guy on the bus, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. I'd love to chat with you. That's my username throughout social media, but Twitter is where I'm most active, so I'd love to chat with you there. Now, if you would like to help us keep this show and all the shows that we just mentioned here going, we could use your help. If you'd like to find out how to get involved in the network, please visit patreon.com/trekfm. That's patreon.com/trekfm to find out how. It takes a great deal of money and time and support to keep the network going. And we really thank everyone who is supporting us right now and invite you to get involved. So please check it out, patreon.com/trekfm. Well, Matthew, I'm going to be busy making that top 10 list that we talked about and getting ready for another discussion with you soon.
Well, Chris, I'll be working on that list as well. But thank you, everyone, for joining us. And we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.